Welcome to Alchemist X Innovators Inside, the podcast where we explore the world of corporate innovation and dive deep into the minds of thought leaders, high achievers, and risk takers. I'm your host, Ian Bergman, and together we'll uncover the challenges, triumphs, and secrets behind successful innovation journeys. Whether you're an aspiring entrepreneur, an industry veteran, or simply curious about the ever-evolving landscape of innovative ideas and what it takes to put them into practice, this is the podcast for you. So grab a cup of coffee, sit back, and let's embark on this exciting journey together. Sebastian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for joining us on Alchemist X Innovators Inside. This is just an opportunity to have really fun conversations about what makes innovation and entrepreneurship hard, what makes it fun. So I'm really looking forward to this.
No, me too. Yeah. Thanks for the invitation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, as our audience knows, we talk on this podcast all the time about some of those friction points, those things that make innovation hard. Looking at your resume, I feel like you're sort of just the living embodiment of some of this conversation. You've been working on big, hard problems for a number of years.
No, yeah, you're right. And maybe there's a bit of kind of being naive in how hard it is, maybe a bit too optimistic. And it's only when you're kind of really in it, like you start to realize that, you know what, I was not expecting that those difficulties to be along the way. But this is why it's interesting, and otherwise many people would do it. So anyway.
That's true. And, you know, making change does require someone to take on that mantle of perseverance. So why don't you tell us, what are you doing? For those of you who aren't familiar with Transpod, they might be pretty excited to hear about this. So can you tell us a little bit about what you're working on right now?
No, thanks a lot. So Transpod is a Canadian company. We're developing a tube transportation system. It's been popularized a few years ago by Elon Musk. So it's known under Hyperloop. Mm-hmm. Even if we're trying to slightly move away from this word. But I mean, just maybe a few words about Musk. I like the entrepreneur. I'm not a big fan of the man.
You know, you're not alone with that sentiment.
No, I know. But yeah, to his defense, if today there's an ecosystem of companies and public sector developing this technology, it's kind of thanks to him.
Yeah.
We're developing a concept which has been around for, I would say, 120 years since the beginning of the last century. And it was a bit dusty. And in 2013, he kind of went to... or revealed that concept to the general public and kind of saying to the world that it was a good idea and companies, private companies like Transpod should develop that. And so there is now five companies. Unfortunately, there's, you know what, maybe six. There is a new one from India, I think, who just started. And 2.5 governments, I would say, South Korea, China, and India developing this technology. So we've been doing that since 2015. But I have to say that we might be the only one who is working on infrastructure projects. So we have one in Alberta to develop a line between Calgary and Edmonton. And there's two other projects as well. There's another one in Texas. We expect to get some approval at the state level this year and maybe in the UAE as well. So those are our main markets, I would say, are North America, Canada, US, the Middle East, mainly UAE and Saudi. And there's some good prospect as well in Australia. So those are.
So you're working on this high speed, potentially very long distance tube transport. So you talk about these markets. I mean, these are markets where you have sizable urban areas separated by a fairly long distance of flat land. Is that kind of how you're defining your markets right now?
No, definitely. And especially where there's no passenger trains.
Right. Nothing right now to take away from the monotony of cars or too short airplane flights.
Yeah, compared to Europe, North America is mainly use freight trains. And the passenger service by ground transportation means is almost inexistent. Same in the Middle East and same in Australia. So those are, yeah, you kind of said it. And maybe a few words for the audience who are not familiar with the technology. We're talking about, so Transpod is designing with the objective to manufacture and sell transportation vehicles to companies like airlines or railway companies or even express freight companies like DHL or FedEx. The vehicle itself is the size of a bus or a train coach. It's an aircraft without wings, so it's kind of 25 meters long with a pressurized cabin. And it uses magnetic kind of levitation and propulsion system. And it's using the basic idea behind the concept, which is to remove 99% of the air in the tube so the vehicle can avoid aerodynamic friction and achieve, in theory, the same speed as an aircraft.
So give us this vision. So, okay, so this is very sci-fi, right? You've got almost the vacuum tubes, minimal friction, bullet traveling through it with people in it. But give us, like, what's the vision for a passenger? What is this experience like that you foresee on a Transpod ride?
Yeah, I'll share a few words on that. Before that, my objective is that at the end of this podcast, you realize that it's not a sci-fi type of system. But anyway.
I want to realize that. Let's do it. Yeah.
And so the vision from a system standpoint is definitely to develop a new transportation network, similar to what the railway industry did 150 years ago when they started to develop trains to connect cities. So talking a tube transportation network where we could travel at the same speed as an aircraft without using fossil fuel. Like literally, it's 100% electrically powered. And the experience for the passenger is, of course, our objective is to provide a better experience than a current transportation system we have today. But in a basic way, it will be similar than the experience we have on an airplane. So the seating arrangement is similar to have on an airplane. We have different configuration, economy class, business class. We'll have some, I would say, some aspect of the system which is going to be similar to trains or public transit. For distances, not too long, I would say, less than 300 kilometers. We're working on a configuration where people could stand just for to be able to transport more passengers and also to allow the ticket to be cheaper than regular ones. So similar to that. And the acceleration itself will be similar to what we have on a subway. Like I say many times, we're not developing a magnetic gun. So the acceleration will range between the one we have on a subway and the one we have on an airplane. So again, to allow everyone to board to the flux jet vehicle, this is how we're calling it.
The float jet vehicle.
Flux jet, yeah.
I love that. And so, you know, what does this do for transit times? Like Edmonton, Calgary is what, about 3 hours by car? Is that right?
That's correct. And so the good reference point about our system is the time we need when we travel. So travel time.
Sure.
So slightly even sometimes quite less. So Edmonton, Calgary, we're talking about 45 minutes to 1 hour travel time. So with our system, we'll be able to do that trip in 40 minutes.
So that's amazing. And compared to obviously driving or flying, where you're dealing with all of the inefficiency at either end of the trip.
No, definitely. And more than the speed, the objective is also to provide a better customer experience. I like to say that Transpod is designing a system with the speed of the aircraft and the frequency of the subway. So it's to remove all the stress we have when we're stuck in traffic. And you have the stress to miss your aircraft or train because, again, you're late and you're going to repay or rebook. Anyway, each time it's a mess. And this time it's to allow people to arrive when they're ready to arrive because they know that they have a vehicle every 2 minutes to go to their destination. So that's the main objective.
I love it. And so besides convenience, what are the other benefits that you foresee? Are there environmental factors, economic factors at play? Like, why do this?
Yeah, thanks for asking. You're nailing it. So we mentioned speed, we mentioned convenience. From an environmental standpoint, we're talking about an elevated structure. So it's above ground. So when it comes to securing the right of way, when we approach farmers, it's not to expropriate them. It's actually to sign a business deal where they can continue to operate their farms. We just need the footprint for the pillars.
Cool.
It's also better for the wildlife. It can continue. We don't have any road crossing. So from a safety standpoint, it's actually better. You are also in a tube, so you protect it from weather conditions. And something only a few people know is that since we're in a low pressure environment, the system doesn't make the amount of the noise is negligible. Like compared to a train or an aircraft, that system doesn't make any noise. And so for the wildlife, for all the surroundings around this transport line, it's actually way better than existing transportation modes. And so those are all the benefits: speed, convenience, environmentally friendly. And the last one, and this is the one we're working on the economics, it's to make it affordable to people. And to do that, so since we're developing some kind of radical innovation and knowing the level of risk the public sector is willing to take, pretty much like we can't rely on public funding to do what we're doing.
Sure.
And so in order to do that, we have to maximize the utilization of the infrastructure. So improve the business case compared to existing lines. And we're mixing with freight. So in order to maximize the utilization, in that same tube, you will have a mix of passenger cars and freight cars to generate revenue and being more profitable than existing systems.
Awesome. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think we're going to come back maybe in a little bit to some of the questions about the downsides, the risks, what you're working on. But I want to hear a little bit more about your story. Like, what made you tackle transportation innovation of all things? Can you tell us a bit about how you got here to be CEO and co-founder of this company?
Happy to do that. Trying to be short or efficient.
It's always tough, but you know, the podcast gets snappy sometimes.
I'm an aerospace engineer by background. I'd like to say that there's different type of engineers, so I consider myself more as an industrial engineer. I'm not good at designing anything. I'm good at building things. So I know how to build a factory, and if I have the blueprint, and yeah, I know the methodology and how to manufacture that. So I started to work for aerospace companies, worked for Airbus and Bombardier. Started in Toulouse, France first. And then after a few years, wanted to change, moved to Bombardier in Montreal, then wanted to change again, worked for Safran, which is another huge aerospace suppliers and so on. And the reason why I was kind of changing, I was looking for a company which was, focused on performance, on efficiency. And I realized after changing a few times that those companies, and there's nothing wrong about that, but like to say are most of the time focusing on employing people, mm-hmm. and the level of performance or the level of, it was not ethical at the level I was looking for. And I'll just use a few examples, and it depends on, of course, the experience from everyone. But on my end, I met too many people who were kind of working for Friday, so which was kind of not an option.
Sure.
And then I ended up to the conclusion that you have three kind of options in front of you. The first one is that you accept the rules of those companies and you make your career like many people do, and there's no shame about that. The second one, which is the one to avoid at no cost, or at all cost, I would say, is when you start to work for Friday. I would push for people to have the courage to drop and to find something more fulfilling. Otherwise, life is just miserable. You do your studies, you start a job, you get a mortgage, your house, you get kids, you retire, and you die. Anyway, I'm sorry, it's kind of a bit straightforward, but
yep.
It's kind of a boring to work for Friday for 40 years. It's definitely don't do that. And the last option is you start your own business. And so if it's successful, then you can showcase a different way of doing business, and it's fulfilling for yourself. And if you're failing, I mean, the only person you can complain is yourself. Even if, anyway, there's a bit of nuance here, but you're in charge. But entrepreneurship is, I would say, not for everyone. Freedom has a price. If you're anxious by nature, I don't recommend anyone to start the entrepreneurial journey. But if you like to be your own boss and like to kind of, be in the driver's seat, that might be a good fit. And it took me a bit more than 10 years to kind of jump. But it took me also almost, 5 years to know what kind of companies I wanted to start.
Yeah, so let's get into that, because I actually want to come back a little bit later and talk about that transition, right? From employee to entrepreneur, from engineer to leader. But let's talk about the type of company that you wanted to focus on. So, you ended up in fundamental transportation innovation. What was it that sparked in your mind, this is what I want to do?
So first of all, I think, and it's actually one of the few recommendations I had from my father.
Oh, great.
He always told me, you know what, start something in what you're good at, meaning that you've done some studies in the transportation sector. Yeah, stick to the transportation sector. If this is what you like, try to do something. And ideally, to be honest, and again, it depends on the nature of everyone. Starting a business for me was not, I didn't want it to start kind of some small potato, and again, nothing against that, but I have a bit of ambition, and I like stuff which is big. Let's aim for the, let's shoot for the moon. let's do that. And when I arrived in Canada, that's why it took a few years to kind of decide what type of company I wanted to do. And when I arrived in Canada, the first idea I had in mind was to start a low-cost company. When you arrive from Europe, you worry about EasyJet, you worry about Ryanair. There's a few as well in the US. And in Canada, there is no low-cost company, no low-cost airlines in the country. And I was kind of, okay, maybe there is...
Well, none that have survived anyway.
Yeah, correct. I start to see there is Flair's now, and there's another one too as well. We're trying to...
Flair just went under, right?
They're not in good shape. Anyway, but there is for whoever is listening to us, if you, we had an idea to start a company. First, the first corridor, busiest one is between Toronto and Montreal. And if you've been in Porter Airlines aircraft, they're using the Dash 8.
Yep.
And the Dash 8, they only have 20% market share. The other aircraft which compete against the Dash 8 is the ATR from Airbus. And the ATR is cheaper from an acquisition standpoint, consume less fuel, and cheaper also from a maintenance standpoint. So if you start to lease one aircraft, you should be able to propose cheaper airline tickets to customers, and you may be able to compete against Porter. The challenge is to get some slots to take off and land, which is another issue. But anyway, so the journey, I mean, to get back to your question, was really about, starting something big and stick to the transportation sector. And then after kind of looking at that, we said, okay, let's move on and try to find something else. And I found out about that transportation kind of system, tube transportation system, from two companies, one actually from the US called ET3, which is barely alive now. And the other one, which actually went bankrupt 2008, was Swiss Metro. Because of the financial crisis, they could not, I would say, continue. But I didn't know how to start, because like you said, when you look at this system for the first time, it really looks like science fiction. You look at that, say, okay, this is nobody, I mean, how come I'm going to be able to raise money?
Sure.
I didn't know where to start.
Well, not just science fiction, but to your point, like there's new type of infrastructure. Like this isn't just magic technology. This is you building a tube across hundreds of miles or hundreds of kilometers, right? Yeah. So, I can see how that would be daunting.
Yeah, yeah. And so when I look at that for the first time, I was like, okay, it's nice to dream, but you're going to go nowhere with that. And what changed, even if we don't appreciate Musk, in 2013, the guy came out and said, wow, this is the system of the future. People should develop that and so on. And then this is when I kind of started to see, okay, Seb, there's a window here. You have a guy who started Tesla and SpaceX. He has an industrial track record. There is back in the days, two of our competitors kind of started also. So the first two companies developing this technology were from the US. But I was kind of still stuck. I was kind of, okay, I'm not Musk. This is nice. The guy is out. He's saying that it's a good idea, but I have no network. I don't know where to get money from nowhere. And in 2015, what changed the game is that Musk started a tender, which ended up to be a student competition at the end, which was open for industrial, I would say, profiles like me and universities kind of students. And then I was kind of, you know what? Yeah, that's nice. We have some specification we need to address and let's try. So I made a few phone calls, called from some former colleagues. And then, yeah, we started kind of to work on that in the evening, during weekends, started to connect with the University of Toronto. This is where I met my co-founder, Ryan, who is kind of the brain of the tech. And then it's that what Musk kind of triggered helped us to kind of start to work on that. And one advice I have for anyone who wants to start a huge project is that don't try to hit the elephant at once. You're never going to succeed.
Yeah.
But try to do it piece by piece, like bite by bite. And where Musk was smart, the competition was not to build the full system. The tender was just build a small prototype which can levitate, or and then there's a jury. And back in the days, we saw an avenue to try to get some money at some point. We're expecting if we're good, we may have some money from SpaceX, Tesla, or Musk himself.
Yeah.
But the man is the man. So I remember those dates. In December 2015, the guy changed the rules. He said, oh, professionals are not anymore allowed. It's only for students. And then we're kind of, we're professionals. So, but he gave us the window. So I had four students in master from the University of Toronto, had the chance to meet Ryan. And then we said, you know what? There's a small group. This is too bad. We didn't do that. We don't want to kind of tell ourselves that we did that for nothing. And we started to, raise money and didn't know how to start, where to start. But this is where sometimes you have a bit of luck. We had a call from an intern from the Toronto Star. So it's one of the main newspapers in Toronto.
Yeah.
We wanted to do an article on the student team from the University of Toronto. And then we said, you know what? Sorry. We're not a student team. The company's name is Transpod, and this is what we're doing, and so on. And I mean, I hung up the phone, was not expecting much. The guy, I was kind of told myself, the guy might be disappointed. We just ruined his internship, whatever, or his article. And 3 weeks after that, we were in the main page of the business section.
Wow.
And the headline was Toronto, Montreal in 30 minutes. And the guy was, okay, those guys are nuts. Anyway, but...
So they just went and set a goal for you right there.
No, definitely. And then we had a week of insane media interviews all over the place. And we went on Bloomberg. And anyway, that was crazy. And that was actually good enough for our first investor who was in Italy to hear about a third company starting this technology after the two US one. And he actually invited us to present the company. He was sponsoring a conference on railway research in Milan. So he paid for the flight ticket, everything. Went there, did the presentation, and then kind of started to discuss. And we had a first investment closed. So the conference was in May 2016, and we closed in November 2016. So anyway, so that's the story.
And from there, it's been off to the races, sort of. We're going to talk about the hard and the slow of it in a second. But I do think this is really interesting because, you know, your story as an entrepreneur starts from a place of wanting to be an entrepreneur, right? Yeah. And doing it in an area where you have some expertise, some academic expertise. And then I heard you kind of layer in this serendipity, right? Right place, right time on this technology. I think that's really fascinating. We have so many of our listeners and people we talk to who are just, you know, like, how do I get started as an entrepreneur? And a lot of people start from the problem they want to solve. And what I heard you say is, I started from wanting to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Yeah, I fully agree with you. And we hear a lot about those pitch deck, what you want to solve, blah, blah, blah. And I'm kind of, no, just do what you like to do.
Just do what you want to do. I love it.
And of course, you need to make sure you're creating something which brings value to society. But I mean, there's a few recommendations we've heard along the way, and some are working quite well. First of all, you need to have a business case which makes sense to attract investors.
Sure.
Otherwise, even if the problem, you're solving a problem but doesn't make any money, you're not going to succeed anyway. And the other point was coming from a huge kind of financial institutions. They said, you know what, it's good to focus on the tech and trying to develop this system. But first, you need to confirm that there's a market.
Absolutely.
Because you may have the best technology in the world. If there's no market, you're not going to go anywhere. And this is why we kind of started to try to get that agreement from Alberta and so on. And I would say that's the main point which help us to attract investment in the company.
Got it. So let's talk about that a bit. So, I mean, you know, successful innovation almost inevitably results in and requires behavioral change. Like, people are going to be doing something different. That's hard. That's when we talk about innovation being hard, that's often the root cause, right? Is it good enough to get people to change behavior? Can we talk a little bit about your experience with what, you know, some of the challenges have been? Like, you've been at this for 9 years, 8 years now, if I did my math right. Yeah. You've made some great progress. What's been hard and slow along the way, and why has it been hard and slow?
So what's been hard, or rather than talking about hard thing and then easier things, is what's the most disappointing aspect of the journey?
Sure.
Is the gap between the, I would say, the official talk we hear every day about innovation and sustainability, net zero, blah, 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 which is usually don't follow, people don't walk the talk. That's the main disappointment. Yeah. We hear a lot that, and it's also coming from the investment community, from everywhere. No one wants to give you money until it's proven.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, okay, guys, if we want to be serious here, we better take some risk. If you want to be a leader as a country, you need to have a vision. You need to know where you're going. You need to know what you want to develop. You need to know which sector do you want to be leader as a country tomorrow. Is it nuclear fusion? Is it quantum computing? And no one even, I mean, I've heard a lot like the VC ecosystem in Silicon Valley, they're just waiting for the next LinkedIn or Facebook. And then on top of that, no one wants to, I would say, develop any hardware because this is risky. It may fail and so on. So, and there's some positive aspect here, like the time we're living in, we have at least some examples. Again, when I'm talking about Musk with Tesla and SpaceX, and we have examples of people, even Steve Jobs and all those guys were kind of pushing the boundaries. So we're kind of lucky in a way that we can rely on those examples to be able to attract funding. And the other positive aspect is that people sometimes complain there's like every year there is more or rich people than the year before. This is actually good news.
It's actually people who can afford discretionary investments. Yeah. Outcome. I think that's right. Obviously, I think there's some societal implications. Maybe we'll come to. But you are right. Like disposable wealth is investable wealth. Now, I will say, you know, you are hitting on something though that we talk about with founders all the time, and I think is really important. Right? You need to have your head wrapped around a problem that people care about, right? A problem that people care about enough, it's painful enough that if you solve it, they're willing to change behavior. They're willing to, you know, vote with their wallets, because otherwise you are just talking about, you know, like nice to have stuff, or you're solving big societal problems. Great, we're going to be a leader in climate tech, but who cares if nobody's actually willing to invest in that? So you framed that as disappointment. Like, what have you learned from that disappointment, and how has that informed your company, right? How have you stayed true to something that people are willing to invest in and use?
So going back to more wealth now than 10 years ago or 20 years ago, like statistically speaking, you have more chances to find investor believing in your project and putting a bit of money in. When it comes to change management, and there is a debate, there is some figures. People says that usually 80% of the population, general population, don't like change or won't change. And then 20% are kind of front runners and will look at the glass half full rather than half empty.
Sure.
I would say it's either 80-20 or 98% looking at the glass half full and 2% half empty. Yeah. Anyway, I'll let you discuss that, and maybe we can run some statistic in there.
It matches with my observations, I think, for sure.
Yeah. And the disappointment is that part of the 80% or 98%, they're trying to convince themselves that they look at the glass half full, where in fact they look at the glass half empty all the time. Mm. This is where it's kind of difficult. To pass, and that valley of death we hear all the time, it's literally something I didn't know before I started my entrepreneurial journey. And I was hearing in the background all that nice things and voices about, no, yeah, we want to address climate change, and we are leaders in innovation. There is lots of money allocated to innovation. This is bullshit. There's no money. Okay. There's just like it's hard. And to make it appealing, you must, perseverance is key. Mm-hmm. And you need to be 200% convinced, but you should not lie to yourself as well. You need to making sure that you have a strong business case. And in our side, we went several times up to a point, like after intense due diligence, where people at the end, they're just lacking courage to sign you a check. The feedback you receive is that great IP, great strategy, great team, everything's great, but no, I'm scared. And so you have to find people who have the courage and the wealth to support that type of project. And then we're going through all the drawbacks of any human beings or a poor quality. Anyway, then through that journey, we face poor behaviors every day. Maybe because of the size of the project we're doing and the amount of money it's attracting. I don't know how many times we've been facing scammers, losers. It's just like...
people are going to people. But... you know, it certainly makes sense to me that you have to find others, whether they're investors, team members, supporters, you know, who share your vision, right? And that vision does matter. How do you keep yourself and your team and your stakeholders focused on that vision, especially when you're working across multi-year, potentially multi-decade timelines? How do you keep everybody aligned?
So going back to Musk's scope of work for that competition, it's important not to lost everyone into a vision which is too far in the future, okay? Like every year, the team must have, I would say, short-term milestones. I would say 3, 4, 6 months away, not more. Otherwise, yeah, you're going to lose everyone.
Yeah.
And then there is that alignment on the vision with kind of milestones on a short-term basis, with clearly keeping the ultimate goal at the end, which is to have the full-scale vehicle and the first infrastructure project. And then you need to work on the strategy. Okay, on our side, we have two things to do. There is the product development, like the vehicle itself, and the infrastructure project. And we need those two to be run in parallel in order to succeed. We can't afford just to focus on the tech. And then when the tech is finished, to look at, okay, where can we implement or sell it? Because the infrastructure projects take so much time, then, okay, we have to do that in parallel. So when the tech is ready, the infrastructure is ready, and then we can commercialize that down the road. And on the infrastructure project, and same as with any other product development, we're trying to mitigate the risk. And something we do, we can't afford the Alberta government in 2 years from now to kind of change its mind and say,
right,
well, we're not interested anymore. Thank you. Bye-bye. Say, no.
Yeah, exactly. Not on a multi-year infrastructure project.
Yeah, that's why we're kind of working as well in other, I would say, regions of the world. For two things, just to mitigate the risk, like I said, but also to implement some kind of healthy competition between countries and regions. Because, the business case on our side is not to rely on public funding. It's to develop those infrastructure projects 100% with the private sector. So we're talking about billions of dollars of investment in those regions. And I can tell you, and we start to see a bit of competition, countries will fight at the end of the day. The first one is the most difficult. But as soon as there's the first corridor and people start to see money to be invested, we'll be super busy.
You know what? I can't wait. You talk about Musk. One of the things that Mr. Elon is famous for are his very ambitious publicly stated timelines, right? And I think sometimes he gets a lot of flack for them, you know, hey, we don't have robo-taxis driving around yet. But at the same time, sometimes dissatisfaction with those statements, I think, you know, make a lot of people blind to the progress that actually gets made, right? And ambitious progress. So, you know, how important are these ambitious publicly stated timelines for you? Do you feel like you are trying to follow in Musk's footsteps to keep stakeholders moving forward?
So to answer your question, no. We have a slightly different approach. You need to set ambitious targets, but at the same time, they must be realistic.
Absolutely.
If you start to say, okay, we're going to be, on the moon, that was one of the main mistakes of our competitor, and also the reason why we succeed to get the investment from this Italian company back in 2016. We were invited by our two competitors, American competitors. One,
this is Hyperloop X.
Yeah, Hyperloop One, and the other one was Hyperloop Transportation Technology.
Got it.
Hyperloop Transportation Technology, they told the guy, we're ready to come, but we want to be the only one, and our price to speak is 10K. So the answer was no. Sorry, you're not invited. and Hyperloop One, they came, and the guy was in charge of their business development, actually made an American speech like Musk liked to do sometimes, saying, "Oh, you will see, this is the transportation system of the future. We'll be able to ride that for $20 between LA and San Francisco in 2020. That was in 2015 or 2016.
Seems ambitious.
Yeah.
Especially in hindsight.
And this is where you need to understand your audience. The audience was made of engineers from the railway sector. And the rail sector, even in Europe, which is used to do high-speed trains, they're not really far behind the one we have in North America. We're dealing with freight trains from the 1950s. So yeah, the level of conservatism was pretty high. And they didn't buy it. They were kind of, that guy doesn't have any clue about what he's talking about and so on. And then I just had the chance to come after that guy. And coming from the aerospace sector, I was aware about the timing to certify the system and how long it takes to build an infrastructure. And I was kind of ambitious, but at the same time telling them, if all the stars are aligned, we could get something built by 2025 or 2030. And it worked. People were kind of, okay, it's more realistic. And so it helps to really kind of tell your audience that you know what you're talking about and you're not lying or, yeah, at some point, if you're too pushy, yeah, people are losing confidence in what you're doing.
Yeah, you got to stay credible. That makes a ton of sense. So I want to pivot a little bit, but I want to talk just a little bit about some additional lessons from your journey. But before we get there, can we just talk a little bit about any pivotal moments in TransPod's journey? So, you know, you've been going for a while, you've learned things along the way. Can you share a moment where you had to change direction, pivot, adapt your strategy, and what lessons did you learn from that?
So there's a few events. The first one was kind of the, this is a key, was an outcome from a DD from a Canadian pension fund. Mm-hmm. And just a simple comment to get back to what I said earlier, confirmed that there's a market.
Yeah.
You may have a good tech if there's no market. And it kind of changes our strategy and say, okay, we must confirm. And it doesn't have to be, I would say, something crazy. For us, it was just a non-binding agreement, like an MOU, with the Alberta government. Just to confirm, okay, we don't want any public money. We just want to work with you. You got nothing to lose. Are you in? Even that, it's. We tried with the federal government, didn't work. We tried with the Ontario government, didn't work. We tried with the French, anyway, didn't work. So, but the Alberta government said, yeah, sure, let's try. And that helped to attract private funding and then get the ball rolling. And this is probably the main reason why we're still here today. Without that document, I'm not sure we'll be still alive. The company will still be around. So that's one thing. And the other one, which is maybe not related to TransPod, but when COVID started, there's one key element to keep in mind when you're running a company and trying to stay alive is cash is king.
So, yes, it is.
And we're kind of, okay, COVID is starting. So first of all, the Canadian government helped a lot, many businesses, and that helped significantly. But I went to the team and said, okay, guys, we're designing a transportation system which can go to 1,000 kilometers an hour. Can we build a ventilator? And then Ryan came back to me and said, yeah, you know what? I may have a design in mind and let's try. And thanks to that, we were able to secure a grant from the Canadian government. A small one was, I think, 400K, like 200K per year for 2 years. And that was enough to kind of continue to pay the salaries and keep going and just try to adapt. So, yeah, you got to be flexible and try to be sensitive to weak signals and say, okay, to really have a good sense of what can work and what cannot.
I love it.
So, which is not always easy. Anyway.
So we're coming up on the end of our time here, but before we started recording, you and I were talking just a little bit about optimism. Are you an optimist? Do you have to be an optimist to take on a project like this?
You need to look at the glass half full. Yeah. By nature, I think entrepreneurs are looking at solutions. When something is brought to you, You're looking at how to make it work rather than why it cannot work. Like this is, I would say, something you must have. And at the same time, where you need to be careful about optimism, you need to be pragmatic as well and realistic. Like, okay, what's the current situation? Not to deny the facts. Yeah, that's critical to be able to recognize that, okay, there's something going well or there's something going bad or wrong in order to address it and correct it. Yeah, that's looking at solutions rather than problems.
Awesome. Well, Sebastian, thank you for joining us. You know, I think one of my takeaways is that it is possible to take a run at an industry, at a sector that feels sometimes very stagnant, right? Transportation, like we've had the same trains, the same planes, the same automobiles for a long time. And at least for me, sometimes it feels incredibly demotivating how hard it seems to be to make change, right? Like California High Speed Rail, just go ask them about the fiasco of trying to bring in change. So it's been awesome to have you on the pod talking about your efforts in this space. For listeners who want to stay in touch either with you or with Transpod, where should they look? Do you have a LinkedIn website? Where should folks go to follow your progress?
They can reach out to us on LinkedIn. Yep. Myself, pretty responsive on LinkedIn as well when people contact me. And we try actually, compared to maybe other companies, to respond to people as much as we can. So it's fairly easy.
Amazing. Well, we'll make sure that's linked in the show notes. And the last question, and I'm sure the hardest question, but the one that's on everyone's mind, when do we get to sign up for a ride?
You know what? We're aiming before 2035.
Amazing.
So construction in Edmonton, the goal is to start next year. Talking about, change, just had a call with the government last week, and they're giving themselves 2 years to define the strategy for passenger rail. So they won't have that until 2026. But because I've asked them, okay, can we go slightly faster? And they said, yeah, if we pressured. Anyway, they're paying attention to private investment. So it's for us to really to execute and making sure that the best way for us to be part of that strategy is actually to spend money in the province and to start building. So
economic development at its best. Well, thank you so much for joining us. This is absolutely fascinating. I will definitely be following your progress really closely, and I wish you the very best of luck.
Thanks a lot. Thank you again for the invitation.
So, cheers.
So that's a wrap for today's episode of Alchemist X Innovators Inside. We hope you enjoyed the conversation. If you found value and insight in today's discussion, please be sure to subscribe to the podcast and never miss an episode. Don't forget to share with your friends, colleagues, or anyone who is passionate about corporate innovation or just curious about great ideas and practical insights. Until next time, I'm Ian Bergman. Thanks for tuning in.